the U.S. Department of Justice under Joe Biden will get back to actually administering justice. And that's why they've been so fierce in trying to stop Ms. Gupta and now Ms. Clark.
And we just have 10 seconds, but what do you understand the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer will do?
He will move this to the floor for a vote. He has to. The Republicans, quite frankly, are just lying again and again and again and not really doing their job.
Ben Jealous, I want to thank you for being with us, President of People for the American Way, former president of the NAACP. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Aaron Dooley. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burfti, Nina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taraseina, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Carinani, Masood, Adriano Contreras, and general managers Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Belka Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Hi, I'm Dina Wilder, and I support John Griffiths by editing his show, Disability Justice, an Everyday Pursuit in Survival. This show is played the first Friday of every month at 9:30 a.m. John's show is an effort to grow the grassroots of advocacy for disability issues, and KBOO is committed to giving community members a platform to have their voices heard. Please support KBOO Nourish the Grassroots of Our Community by going to kboo.fm/give.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Friday. Coming up next is The Gap. And as our friends were saying earlier, you can support KBOO's Growing the Grassroots campaign. Got a $60,000 goal, about 34-something into it. Thanks in part to Valerie, Christina, Bruce, Kim, and you. Text KBOO to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/give to join up with your friends and neighbors in supporting your community radio. For old schoolers, you can just mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. However you do it, you just do it at the level that makes sense to you. And why not, if you can, why not kick in a little extra to cover the people who are feeling a pinch from the last year and change? With that, mind the gap, because we gon' bridge it, because girls are powerful. Stay tuned. We got technical weirdness right off the bat. Go us. With that, let's just bring in the rest of the girls who are very powerful. Tammy and Althea.
Hello, everyone. I guess if we want to, we can always do the theme song ourselves, but I will spare. I will spare the both embarrassment. Oh, and there it is. The embarrassment and the, you know, I'll spare the listeners and myself. Mm-hmm. But yes, that's right. I am Tammy. This is KBOO. And you are listening to The Gap. On the line with me is the fantastic, fabulous Althea. How are you, Althea?
Hello. Good morning. Doing okay. admittedly, you know, coming in with a different energy without hearing Beyonce, but that's okay. That's okay. We can do that.
Yeah, we can do it. It usually wakes me up and peps me up, but it is what it is. Just gotta keep on keeping on. And mm-hmm. we have a pretty great show for you today. And I guess we can just pop right in there. We're going to be starting off with the results for the 2020 census. It's starting to trickle in, and there have already been some major changes from the results that we've got. They're still figuring some stuff out, but there's a couple of things, both federally, nationally, and then of course more local, and specifically for Oregon and Portland. So we're going to be touching on that. And Dolphia, what was kind of your response from seeing the census results online?
Well, first of all, it's, you know, very impressive that a decent census taking was possible with COVID in the way and with all of the changes that were, you know, attempted to add the citizenship question and all of that. And we haven't totally seen all of what it entails, but there's a lot of things. And it's interesting to look at the period from 2010 to 2020. One of the most, I think, significant ones in broad terms is that U.S. population growth actually slowed. We had the slowest growth since the Great Depression, and as, you know, old-timers who remember 2010 might know, we were coming right off the heels of the Great Depression. So our population growth has been the slowest since the Great Depression. And I think, and it's interesting to, right, because we can see that that's the data point, right? And then from that, and that's what the census gives us, is a lot of data points, and we can try to, you know, like, interrogate why we see the trends that we see. And so, obviously, like, financial insecurity off of the Great Recession would impact birth rates and other things like rising healthcare costs. That's not necessarily an incentive to have more kids, but that's something that is, you know, general insecurity will oftentimes have a decline in birth rate. And we did see some shuffling of like reapportionment for seats and stuff, and, you know, notably Oregon got additional congressional seats. We had a bunch of population growth, and so we will get another representative in Congress,
which is huge. And we are not going to be the only ones. There's some other states that include, I think, hold on, I'm going to look here at my notes, Texas, which will be receiving two, as well as Colorado, North Carolina, Florida, and Montana, which will be gaining one. Interestingly enough, on the other hand, California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia will be losing seats. So that's also, I forgot that, you know, I always thought of, like, redistricting because of, like, things getting larger. I never thought that cities can actually, states can actually lose seats. So that was kind of a wake-up call for me.
Yeah, and from what the data was showing, it's in, like growth. I think there's a difference between, like, gross population compared to 2010 versus, like, because only three states actually had population loss over the past 10 years, and that was Illinois, West Virginia, and Mississippi. Mississippi notably hung on to all of its seats. But West Virginia, they have the highest, they have a much older population, so theirs is more explained by, you know, death rates. But Illinois, one of the explanations as to why Illinois lost people was, like, people moving away, some kind of exodus. Some people want to blame taxes, people moving away to a more tax-friendly state. But yeah. And especially politically, right, because this relates to representation in the House. It also relates to Electoral College votes. And, like, looking at a map of sort of seeing where there is, you know, a loss of seats, what, you know, demographers and you know, political experts are saying is like you're seeing kind of the concentration of political power and political might migrate out of the Northeast and, you know, the traditional Midwest being like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio, because they're all losing seats, and that there is growth in the West and in the South. I mean, Texas has got two more seats. So I think that's really notable as well.
Yeah. And there is, I mean, I think that what the redistricting is, like what it might look like is, I can't really imagine what that would look like for us, like, you know, with that, like on a day to day. So I'm really interested in, you know, how this will affect us. If this will, I don't know, it just who will that person be? So that's going to be something that we
in Oregon need, or across yeah, the U.S.
In Oregon, yeah, well, that specifically, was, I guess. I'm just looking here at home, being a little myopic. Sorry.
No, you're good. Well, that's another thing that I think is worth noting as well, is that it's state legislatures that are tasked with redrawing the boundaries of these different districts, and redrawing those districts has a really big impact on who's going to win there. Redistricting, gerrymandering, that's the thing that we're looking at, and one of the, I don't know that we ever talked about it on the show, but definitely in like watching the 2020 election, kind of after, you know, like what are some big ballot measures that people are seeing, and like, you know, who, what control is in the Congress or whatever, but then also on the level of who controls the state house, because that gives an incredible amount of control to redraw districts, and, you know, it's oftentimes a determinant of what is to come in the next 10 years politically, based on who draws the lines and what restrictions they do or don't follow.
I wonder, you know, these lines, this is all, you know, like has a lot to do with, you know, a lot of like what we've been seeing. There is, you know, as far as the political spectrum, there's fear of gerrymandering. There's fears like what kind of representation this will be, and I think that it would be kind of, you know, we can't ignore 2020 and what that brought, and all of its, you know, how just folks are, A, becoming more politically active, but also are demanding more of their politicians. So I really wonder what this could look like. And I'm reading here at the AP, there is an article, Priscilla Southwell, who's a political poli-sci professor at University of Oregon, saying that in 2020, 42% of Oregonian voters casted their ballot for a Republican U.S. House candidate, but they still only have one representative. So that's kind of where I'm just interested to see, because there are political truths and there are kind of a cultural truth that we're living in now post 2020. So it's something to be mindful of, and I hope that, and I know that we'll be here obviously covering it and keeping everyone updated on KBOO.
Yeah, and what's interesting in Oregon, particularly with the redistricting process, and we kind of had an idea that this is going to happen back when the census was still being taken, that there's like, hey, from what we know about the, you know, population growth, we think we're going to get another seat, but it's important that everybody gets counted. But that, you know, there is, so to be clear, Democrats control Oregon in the state house, in the state senate, and obviously in the governor's office, and four of our five current representatives in the U.S. House are Democrats. But breaking that, like taking the state and breaking it down again into six parts, if you're a Democrat, you are hard pressed to draw that into five Democratic districts and one Republican district. That's not to say that like won't happen, or that, you know, the new district will be more competitive between Republicans and Democrats, but that representing the part of the state that leans Republican, we could really see that there is more competition in the state in terms of, and a mix of which party represents Oregon federally. And that, you know, based on whatever the process is going to be, This is from back in April, looking at from AP, that Democrats are ceding some amount of their advantage for redistricting in exchange to get Republicans to stop blocking bills in the Oregon legislature by walkout. So we will see what that ends up looking like, and giving, you know, Republicans more say about what do our state legislative districts look like, as well as what do our congressional districts look like, and how to break, you know, congressionally into six parts.
It's not easy. It's not easy. And just for general, just for listeners, just generally, very briefly, redistricting in itself is the way that districts are I don't want to say divided, but how districts are divided. And of course, for each one of those areas, it needs to be a representative. And since we still use this like archaic version of like commissioners and stuff like that, I think that it kind of makes this process maybe a little bit more toxic, because there's a lot of interest and a lot of power from people who have been in local government for longer, and also I think that there's like a big interest in keeping and not getting things to change things too much. But I think this will bring like a great change to it, and I think instead of like, I think there might be a lot of fear around it, so maybe embracing that it could actually be something good for us, you know, living here in the city, not something, or just like, all, you know, in Oregon, and not just, I don't know, being scared of what this could lead to.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that clarification there, right? Like, redistricting is something that has to happen every 10 years because we get more people and people move around, and part of what is,
and the interest change of the people too, you know, with all those changes.
Totally. And because of that, every 10 years we have to redraw the areas to make sure that they have the same amount of people in them, which is why if you look at like a current map of Oregon's districts, or really, you know, any Western states district, right, you'll see some smaller congressional districts around the urban areas, and rural areas are, those congressional districts can be way, way bigger because there's less population density. And redistricting isn't a bad thing, and there's a lot of different philosophies about what should be like the base value when you go about redistricting, and that's in any state. And so for some parties, they're really interested in putting in safe seats. They want to make sure that that could be one of them. Some state legislatures are interested in competitiveness, so wanting to kind of have an equal amount of people who oppose each other, or putting people of similar groups or similar ideas in the same area so that they can make like choices for themselves on a congressional level or on a state legislative level. Those are all different values, but because there isn't like one overarching value that everybody's agreed to, that like, oh, it's the most important for us to draw safe seats, or it's the most important for us to draw competitive seats, there's not like the legal process of like, hey, is this district valid or not, is super duper complicated. And that, you know, there's a lot of like probably litigation that will come after the redistricting process, as, you know, advocacy groups will be challenging like, hey, you packing and cracking is a gerrymandering tactic. I don't know that we want to totally get into all of that here, but it is used both like by political party and also oftentimes in like racial designations to basically try to split up political power. So what will happen sometimes is like, say that there's, you know, sort of a smattering of Republicans in a particular city. You can draw some pretty wild boundaries to make it contiguous, to put them all in one district, so that whatever, they're not competitive in three districts, they're safe in one, versus cracking, which would be to put them in a bunch of different districts so they don't have enough political power to compete. All of these different types of things that are sometimes there's not that are challenged legally, like in the court system and stuff, but there's not necessarily like strong foundations as to what is and is not acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the description, it's that was a great description. Thank you, Althea. It's very easy to weaponize this, and you know, the validity of these almost, not saying the validity of these districts, kind of depend on how much value they bring, right? So, like you're saying, these advocacy groups and grassroots organizations are really gonna have to advocate for the people living in these districts, because you know, not all, you know, some districts are more affluent than others, and like you just said, this is a perfect way of of just like, if you have the wrong representative, it can really be very harmful for whatever community they're supposed to be representing. And it's very, very easy to weaponize this. And it sometimes, like, you know, we talk about these things, and you know, from things going federal, and not just redistricting, but a lot of these things that we talk about that we're, you know, I realize that the only difference, or the only reason why things haven't gone completely haywire, is just because of like a status quo, or just because of advocacy groups or something. The fact that these positions have so much power on our day-to-day lives, and yet their interests for a lot of the times don't align with our own. So just the fact that it takes another, like a group of people to say no, or just you know, just the you know, just like the status quo of it's never been done before, so we're just not going to do it, or it could just very easily go wrong, you know, like go the other way, depending on who's representing. So it's very, very important to hold them accountable even before they're in there. So I know this is going to be a lot. There's going to be a lot to report on coming up in the next little bit. Also, there's some new ballots being presented, so it's exciting time.
Yeah. Sonia, you want to chime in here?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about the safe districts and how there's a definite partisan advantage to, you know, having a lock for your party, right? The danger in there is that then candidates may become less and less sensitive to the specific needs of the actual people in that district, because they don't have to campaign. They don't feel they have to really do anything, because, hey, it's all registered Democrats here. Like, what are they going to do?
I agree
with
you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So, Tam, when you mentioned the potential toxicity of the process, you know, that's so much is focused on parties, that, and it's people who have their job because of their participation and allegiance to party, you know, who are going to be drawing these district maps, making, you know, forming these districts. And so we know, like, as you said, the interests don't always align with those of the people, or any one particular group, or any number of groups of people or communities. And you're talking about keeping people accountable, holding them accountable now, so when they get started on this, they know that they're going to have to answer to us.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and because one of the things another, you know, sort of philosophical aspect about redistricting is thinking about what is the value of your vote? What does my vote matter? And thinking about what is the difference in a, you know, competitive district versus a safe district. If you're in the losing party in a safe district, does it matter if you vote? Or even if you feel that you have a safe majority, does your vote have the same amount of weight? And that's another, you know, thing that redistricting will try to attack in some cases, is decreasing the voting power of, you know, whomever you want to insert into this situation. And I mean, I also just want to bring up briefly the voter suppression laws that are being passed on in a bunch of different Republican states, that this is also related to the census, related to redistricting, related to shifting centers of political power, related to demographic change, that voter suppression is not like, and it's interesting to talk about because I think it can sometimes get dismissed because it doesn't have an obviously biased face, right? That there's not, and this is like, of course, legally they can't say, well, actually, we just kind of want to restrict voting. We want to make voting harder for anybody who won't vote Republican. They can't say that in the language, but that is effectively what's happening. And that's something that I think is like worth thinking about, is what is the impact in practice rather than what is the words that they're saying.
Well, that gets to...
Because I think that's how people get tripped up about, you know, redistricting or, you know, voter ID laws, stuff like that. I don't know. Sonia, go ahead, please.
Well, when it comes to redistricting, explicitly redistricting for partisan advantage is perfectly okay. It's explicitly legal. But not for, like, on, like, any... protected class, like, let's say under the 14th Amendment. I had something else. Intent versus impact is also a long established legal principle where they have what they call the test, right? If you can show that a piece of legislation would have an unlawful impact, then it can be struck down, regardless of there being any of the presence or absence of any explicit language. You know, you don't have to prove that this legislation is intended to create an outcome. You just show that in the normal operation and implementation or enforcement of this law, it would have this effect regardless of any intent, then there you are.
And right, and looking at the validity of redistricting processes, those are things that get weighed out. It's like, well, right, because the partisan thing is totally legal, but it's like you also have to weigh, you know, geographic areas. Is it somewhat contiguous? And what are, like, the groups that live in this area? But it's like, important that those things are considered rather than explicitly used. So it's complicated like that. Thank you for bringing that up.
It reminds me of Trash Day.
Do tell.
Yeah, I shall. I've had several addresses just like in Portland alone, and more than once I've been like kind of on the edges of different trash day areas. Like, my street gets picked up on Monday, the next street over gets picked up on Sunday, or some in the next street. The next street in the other direction gets picked up on Wednesday. So there's like three or more days a week I'm hearing trash and recycling trucks coming down and banging and bashing at, you know, 5 a.m. Multiple times every week. So like, you see how the impacts of drawing districts. That's all.
Wow,
crickets.
And that goes back to that how like these things, you know, something like that, because, you know, it does impact you. Sure, it's not something that's, you know, too bombastic, but it still impacts you, you know, something that you have to be mindful of. And just I wanted to give a really general rundown of what these, I guess, new maps, what the deadlines for them are, because it's obviously not, you know, not going to happen in the next few days. So alongside with the Secretary of State, the congressional seat nominee or senior representative, if they can't figure out what the redistricting looks to a special judicial panel. And the actual deadlines under that scenario would be October 18th to complete the maps with legal challenges. The Oregon Supreme Court has to set by February 7th, 2022, and then the dates have to be finalized by March 8th, 2022. The deadline for candidates to file that's the date for the candidates to file for the May 17th primary. So we're still, you know, still a ways ahead. But yeah, like, you know, like Sonia, I'm just going to echo what you're saying. You gotta keep them accountable even before they get in there, because once they're in there, and folks then have the support of their candidates or other large interest groups or something like that. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon. That's exactly all the wisdom I have.
Well, yeah, and then that's what's in place for the next 10 years. So this is an important process. We're waiting until 2030 to get a redo. And I also want to mention, because I don't know that we made it clear earlier, that even if states didn't get an extra seat or lose a seat, they still have to redraw their boundaries because of, like, you know, people moving around in the state where are, like, the centers of population, making sure that they're still breaking themselves up into equal pieces based on where people are living.
And again, it goes back, I'm sure listeners are familiar, but in case you forgot, the census is done every 10 years. This year, obviously, there was a little snafu with 2020 being the year that it was.
A snafu,
yeah, way to minimize.
I thought these were unprecedented times.
The census does
a hiccup in 2020. That's what they're going to put in the history book. Sort of this global pandemic presented kind of a hiccup to global trade and the economy, but you
and
know.
Census taking.
I'm sorry.
No, I think it's funny. It is technically a snafu.
We had a bit of a snafu in 2020, so we're getting the results now, and these results again, the census is very important in the sense of allocating funds, government funds, redistricting, like we're seeing now. Also it's a neat way of, we're seeing a lot of the Historical Society was able to do a lot of projects through the census, because, you know, of people who lived in the city and being able to, you know, to kind of see, you know, if your family's from the region, to see where they've been. So that's also a neat little thing. But yes, definitely as far as funds, big word, funds and money, because, you know, we're living in the world that we're living in. So not having that kind of poses a threat to living. So just a quick rundown of the census. Some of the results, they're online. They're still working on getting it out, but...
Yeah, there's more info to come related to the census.
It's just interesting how this is 40 years seems to be the big number that I'm getting from all this. It seems like this is the most change that there's been since 40 years ago. So that's interesting. I guess we're finally getting over the Great Depression.
Well, the Great Depression was more than 40 years ago, but...
Okay, not the Great... Excuse me, that's what I... The 20s, right? Yeah, my bad. The Roaring 20s, yeah. But we're doing it. We're making it. And the one other thing I wanted to mention before we go to our musical break is that there are some conversations already being had around what the 6th congressional district, you know, what that would look like. And some people are suggesting that it goes to the coast. So that's an interesting thing. There's more info on it online. And, you know, if you have internet connection, it is available there. Other than that, Althea, do you have any other things that I left off about this part one of our show today?
I think you were very thorough. I can link some resources on our show notes as well. But I think we are ready to hit that musical break.
I've got a couple things.
Awesome, yes.
You mentioned how, with 2020 being unprecedented, and so it's taken until now to get the figures back. When the census is constitutionally mandated, and it's done every 10 years because it took at least 7 to 9 years to collect and to collect all that data and compile it and make it, you know, usable. You know, so it was an almost constant process because that's how long it took to get all that information and make it usable and then actually use it. And also, I learned something interesting about anything that's, if you notice, some people have noticed before how crime rates seem to go in this cycle. Even as it goes up or down, within the rise or decline, there's these little skips and jumps, and they seem to happen every 10 years or so. Crime rate seems to plummet every 10 years and then gradually rise. And that has to do with population, because every 10 years, new population figures come in, and the population, and the denominator of the fraction that is a crime rate, one of the figures in the ratio suddenly changes when those new figures come available. So when you're looking at trends that have to do with population, you know, and looking at trends over time, that's something to always keep in mind, that the figures change, you know, cyclically. Should we introduce our community question?
Let's do the musical break first, and we'll be back in about a minute.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, thank you for that. You're listening to The Gap. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you. You are listening to The Gap here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Tammy, and the line with me is Althea, and of course, our terrestrial angel, the one and only Sonia.
Mm-hmm.
We are here in part two for our community question. Before I throw it over to Althea to present your question, I just wanted to remind you of the phone number, because we are going to be taking calls, 503-231-8187. Althea, what is that community question for folks?
Yeah. So So we're interested today in talking about good faith discussion. Tammy and I have some pointers for good faith discussion, but we want to know, what are your pointers for holding a good faith discussion, and where have you had success in doing so? Give us a call, 503-231-8187. We would love to hear your perspective on that.
Good faith discussions. Ah, yes. So like Althea said, we have a couple of tips, and I think we can just go right into them.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's see. First of all, before you, these are just suggestions, and we are definitely love to hear your suggestions. Again, that phone number is 503-231-8187. First tip, what is the intention of this discussion? Is it going to be a discussion? Is it going to be just an engagement? Is it going to be a debate? All of it, whatever form of conversation you choose or want it to be, it must be in good faith, but you have to also gain consent from the person whom you're having this engagement with, this discussion with, to see if it is a discussion, an engagement, or a debate, so that they know how to come at you. But then also it gives you a baseline as to how to come at them, or how to go about it. And then if you find yourself, it is, you know, for example, if this is a just a discussion and not a debate, and you find yourself getting very defensive or something, I would recommend to first realize, say to yourself, oh wait, this was supposed to just be a discussion and I'm getting a little heated. And as they say, check yourself before you wreck yourself. So that's the first tip. Althea, do you want to go to another one, or do you want me to read some of these off?
Well, yeah, I wanted to maybe like briefly define what we mean by a good faith discussion. I think it should be for us, and like thinking about it, just because, I mean, the world events, connecting with people, you know, there's more opportunities to talk to people because, you know, COVID restrictions have decreased somewhat. And thinking about, you know, there are like contentious conversations to have, whether they're political or interpersonal, and thinking about how do you set yourself up for success? How do you make sure, you know, in every way possible, and obviously you can't like control whoever you're talking to, but what can you do to try to have that conversation, like stay in a productive place, stay in a place where, you know, you're not feeling individually like threatened or defensive? Because I've totally been in those conversations, and it's sort of like sometimes you get to the point where it's like, oh, this is bad and I'm feeling bad and angry and threatened, and I need to, and before, but what am I trying to say? You get to that place without realizing that that's where you ended up. And so we're thinking about, you know, like if you know you're going to go into some kind of conversation that might be contentious, how can you come with your best foot forward? Let's say that. And if you have thoughts about that, or if you've had success with good faith discussion, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And one of the other tips we were thinking about is to take care of yourself before you start, and check your own like emotional state before you start to engage, and as you're going as well. That, you know, and we've talked about this on the show before, but I think it still holds true that especially, like, I don't know, language and vocabulary can have certain connotations, and that the person that you're speaking to may not have a full understanding of like what you hear those words to mean. And I've definitely like gotten worked up in certain conversations because of, you know, the connections that particular language that they're saying I make connections to. Well, if you say that, then you must also believe X, Y, Z thing. And all of those things are like fundamentally threatening to me, my beliefs, and my way of life. And so what I'm trying to say is check in with yourself before you start. Like, are you available to have this kind of conversation? You don't have to agree. And again, that kind of goes to what kind of conversation you're trying to have. Is it a debate? Is it an argument? Is it a discussion? How can you keep it into a place that is productive, and that even if you're not going to agree at the end of it, you're committed to coming away with some kind of understanding that you didn't have initially?
And I think, well, okay. So another thing that we, another tip that we have is to not dismiss someone's lived experience. Just because you have one point of view does not, especially if it's a hyperbole point of view where you say, oh, everyone in this town is great. And then someone says to you, I've actually met someone who wasn't too kind. And you say to them, that's not true. Don't do that. Please don't do that. The differences between a point of view and someone's experience is something to, that shouldn't rattle your sensibilities too much, I think. If you think that everyone in this town is nice, but someone's telling you that their lived experience is different, that is their truth, and that can't be minimized. It cannot be dismissed. And listening to someone's lived experience as well as validating them doesn't cost you anything. If anything, it might open up your mind to think, oh, you know, kind of step outside of your own shoes and think, oh, wait a second, this is their lived experience. Maybe there's something that I don't know, which can be scary. It can be very scary, but it's okay. It is okay. If it's coming in a good faith discussion, that validation and that listening, that's a part of a good faith discussion, is that it will be reciprocated to you. Just for listeners who are just tuning in, we're talking about good faith discussions, and we want to hear from you. What kind of pointers do you have for holding a good faith discussion? And what kind of success have you had with having a good faith discussion with someone? Phone number is 503-231-8187.
Althea? Yeah, especially with the lived experience idea, that being able to listen and to understand someone else's perspective doesn't even mean that you have to change your mind, you know? And I think that sometimes folks will have their walls up from hearing those things because they're unwilling to address those implications. But coming to it from like a human level and being able to, you know, listen, comprehend, validate that somebody has a different experience from you and take that into consideration is very much the basis of a good faith discussion. Another one that, well, Tammy and I were brainstorming, another one that we thought about was, you know, getting out of binary type thinking, that something is either good or it's bad, that it has to be one way, that there's only one right answer to any particular question. It's not that way. And if you are in that kind of binary thinking, it does not leave a lot of room for, you know, the complexities of human life, which are very much not within the binary in any sense. And so kind of getting out of that way of thinking that, you know, if you're in some kind of discussion or argument that someone's right and someone's wrong, and that's the way that it has to be, because it really isn't that way. And I've had conversations where that had to be addressed, that, you know, I think that you are trying, like, you're arguing for a position that I don't even know if you agree with, but why are you coming to the table with the idea that I'm wrong when I'm trying to explain something that, and how I understand it? And that goes a little bit into like devil's advocate behavior, but like acknowledging that ended up being helpful because it got out of the right and the wrong and who has, you know, the moral high ground, if you will, in those kind of conversations.
Oh, yeah. And I've seen conversations go in a way where, you know, I think a lot of people have had discussions and talks with people and conversations, and I think that we can kind of tell when someone is coming at us in, like, not good faith, you know, or kind of just this thing that's very popular with the kids where they ask you a question and they don't actually want you to answer. They just want you to say something so that they can then rebuttal it, which is not good faith. That is not a good faith argument. Listening is huge. And then language is also a very, very big part of it. But Althea, I know that you have a lot of opinions about folks who call themselves devil's advocates. would you like to explain where that plays in a good faith argument, if at all?
Yeah. I'm laughing just thinking about it because of the great well of emotion that I have about the idea of being a devil's advocate. And even just that the phrase is so commonplace, just a devil's advocate here, like, how we consider this from another perspective? Considering from other perspectives is great. Love to do that. I'm interested in thinking about things from other perspectives. But you're literally saying devil's advocate. Look at something from a different perspective without being that person. And it kind of goes into what I was mentioning a moment ago, which is that you don't have to, like coming into a conversation with somebody, if they have a strongly held point of view, you don't have to immediately position yourself as their opposition, right? Like, if someone feels very strongly that the sky is blue, I don't need to come in and be like, actually, it's green. And just to, for the sake of argument, just to be devil's advocate here, I think the sky's green, actually, and let's kind of hash this out. When you could just have the conversation about, oh, you're interested in that, you think that the sky's blue, like, that's very interesting, like, what brought you to that conclusion? There's a lot of different ways to have conversation rather than coming at it from, I'm defending the opposite thing of the other person that I'm with. And it sounds very simple, but you'd be surprised at how that is sometimes like a default way of being. Whether or not you like know that person, whether or not you know that you commonly disagree with that person, that there is, and it's difficult to get somebody out of that headspace, but there are a lot of topics. There's a lot of topics that don't need a devil's advocate in the discussion, first of all. And second of all, it's not often conducive to good faith discussion. Especially, and this is something that we didn't like prep per se, but especially because there's an expectation of emotional detachment from like political discussion or interpersonal discussion, as like that emotional detachment and rationality is expected to be the baseline, and that deviation from that is considered like irrational or weakness. And I feel so strongly that that is not the case. And we can talk about how that's like, you know, sexist or whatever, but that,
yeah,
like,
that itself is rooted in, yeah,
in sexism, but that, like, you know, the baseline of every discussion is not going to be that we are having a coldly rational discussion about something that is far away from us, and that, you know, different people come to different conversations with a different like baseline of emotional engagement and what it means to them personally to have their point of view, to have their experience. And we, like, there just should not be there should not be an expectation that every discussion, political, what have you, is going to be calmly rational. And just because whoever you're talking to seems to get emotionally agitated, that doesn't mean you're right. That doesn't mean you're winning. That doesn't mean you won the argument. That's what came to mind for me.
That's just you being nice, a nice way of saying being a contrarian is not a personality trait. It's just annoying.
I love that. Yeah.
And yeah, I think it brings me back one more time for listeners. I would love to hear your point of view on this. 503-231-8187 about good faith discussions and holding them and your success with it. Language is a huge, huge, huge thing when having a good faith discussion. And it's very, I think that a lot of times, I don't mean using these academic words and all of these, whatever words and not being familiar with them is, you know, totally fine. But things like using someone's proper pronoun and not doing, you know, misgendering someone just to hurt them, just to get your point across or something. When you use certain words, like, for example, right now what's happening in Palestine, Gaza, and Israel, you know, people are referring to it as a conflict. Well, Well, if we just look at what conflict actually means, where it's a conflict is a clash of interests. That's the first way to define it. It's not a clash of interests when there is literally an occupying armed physical military force occupying a land. So that's not quite a conflict, you know. So even when coming at these situations, calling things what they are, and understanding the words that you're using, because there could be someone who says, oh, it's not an occupation, it's a conflict, but then you have the definitions, and they can just, well, as far as it comes to that, I mean, the UN and Israel themselves have called it an occupation, so that's just staring your head in the sand. But the point is to use language that is both validating, but also you understanding fully what the words mean. And then also being aware that sometimes the person that you're speaking with might not understand, might use a word without fully understanding what it means, but still it has some sort of gravitas or connotation. For example, liberal agenda or socialism, which are words that have been, that I think a lot of times in argument, I think they represent something as opposed to actually meaning the word that they mean. I hope that's clear. I'll see if you, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I get what you're saying. We were phrasing it as, like, there's a lot of terms that get thrown around as, like, I don't know, the boogeyman, or like, this is the bad thing, and not like the radical leftists, and it's Marxism, and they're all doing Marxism. But when it comes down to it,
everyone Marxism, is doing Marxism all over the place.
They're trying to do Marxism in America, and we can't have that because America is not Marxist. Marxism is like a frame of academic thought, and that's not really how it's often, you know, deployed on the right. And there's a lot of different like versions of that that can be difficult to like deconstruct in the heat of a conversation, but they're worth doing. Or deconstructing the idea of socialism is another good one that gets thrown around. But one thing, I had two thoughts. One of them is that the politicization of particular words, one, is inevitable. The world and life is political, so like bemoaning that doesn't really do much good, but that is part of the reason that you know, our electoral outcomes don't necessarily match as closely what people's, like, opinion polls, per se. Opinion polls show that, by and large, America is more progressive than our electoral outcomes would suggest. People are, like, first of all, we already have socialism to some extent in this country. Social Security exists, Medicare exists. Second of all, people are like in favor of those policies, even though if you're like, hey, do you think socialism is good? There's a lot of fear around that term. But the other thing that I wanted to encourage was just getting curious about your own language usage. Getting curious about, you know, well, I use this term and it seems like that has an implication that I wasn't aware of. And is that something that I am trying to imply here? And if that is what I'm trying to imply, is it impeding my ability to like connect with and converse with somebody who, when they hear that, like, that is telegraphing some opinion that I don't necessarily have? And that's where like the contrarian thing comes in. It's like, you know, oh, I'm gonna say whatever I want, but it's like being precise in your language and being interested in a new way to express yourself, I think is really important in thinking about trying to do good faith discussion and trying to engage with people where they're at.
And this is, again, goes back to like one of the first points where what are you trying to do? Are you trying to have a discussion, a debate, an engagement? And just kind of having that in the back of your head when you do catch yourself starting to feel heated or defensive or something. And I'm not, that tip doesn't come from, you know, you get emotional, cut it out. It's coming from obviously something is creating tension within yourself, and it might not allow you to be your best self. And I think, in my personal opinion, dialogue, it can really like change, it can change lives, you know, like people having a good faith discussion, it can really open up people's eyes, and that's all, you know, that's all we want, is for someone to see us or see what we mean or understand, you know, or feel us, you know, hear me, see me, you know what I mean? So just being able to have like at least some sort of baseline with yourself, and also gaining the consent of the person, so that now you're not in a position where you're just trying to engage and they're debating you. Because that's just, you know, that's just, you know, getting assaulted physically, or excuse me, verbally assaulted, and no one wants that. And then also the second point is, you know, did you eat today? You know, did you drink water? Did you sleep enough? Because sometimes having these discussions without being physically and mentally prepared is just going to drain you. And that's where emotional labor, you know, we hear that word a lot. I hear that word a lot. And I think that sometimes not wanting to deal with, you know, emotional labor is something that's hard. So we, you know, if we're out here trying to change things, then we got to be kind to ourselves first. You know, you can't fill a cup when you're empty. There's a meme somewhere that said that, and it resonated with me.
I think it's well said. Well, I want to thank you, Tammy and Sonia, for having good faith discussion with me here today. This has been The Gap. I want to briefly mention that KBOO is in our spring membership drive. We would love for you to become a member and support all of the wonderful programming on this station. We have a $10,000 match until the 22nd, so your money can go doubly far. You can check that out at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 and support your local community radio station.
Thank you all so much for tuning in. This has been The Gap. Coming up next at 9 is Arab Voices. You're going to be hearing a lot of what's been happening in the region. I recommend sticking around for it. Thank you so much, Althea. Thank you so much, Sonia. This has been great. All the good faith discussions and many more are going to be coming up. We are here every week, Friday, 8 a.m. The Gap. Thank you so much. Have a fantastic weekend.
Bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming and online.